Last Thursday, over 50 world leaders gathered at a nuclear security summit hosted by President Obama that illustrated just how drastically the global conversation on nuclear weapons has evolved in the years since the Cold War. The Washington, D.C. summit centered around disposal of nuclear waste and weaponized nuclear fuel and keeping existing weapons away from terrorist groups like ISIS.
The danger of a terrorist group obtaining and using a nuclear weapon is one of the greatest threats to global security.
But a single use of a nuclear weapon poses virtually no threat to the global climate. But in the early 1980s, while the United States and the Soviet Union were committed to a mutually assured destruction strategy, the discussion about nuclear security was all about who would fire first and what would happen to the planet from the impact of multiple nuclear blasts. Carl Sagan and a number of other scientists said that a full-scale nuclear war would produce what they called a nuclear winter. The gases from the explosion and firestorms of nuclear blasts would block out the sun, plunge the Earth's temperature, and decimate our food supply, spelling the end for humanity.
Beneath the clouds, virtually all domesticated and wild sources of food would be destroyed. Most of the human survivors would starve to death. The extinction of the human species would be a real possibility.
A new documentary from our friends at the Retro Report explores how this theory steered the Cold War strategy at the time, had real impact, and helped pull the superpowers back from the nuclear brink. With me now to talk about what lessons we may have learned from that is Andy Revkin, writer of the Dot Earth blog with the New York Times and a professor at Pace University. Welcome, Andy.
Great to be with you.
So this nuclear winter idea was very powerful at the time, and it had impact on policymakers?
It was pretty stark stuff. It came at a point when people were seriously worried. You and I think, are both old enough to recall what the Cold War was like, and certainly from the 60s forward. And then, at that time, there was a lot of tension and a lot of possible adverse outcomes. And scientists began to calculate, no one had ever actually tallied if you burned enough cities, how much stuff would go into the air and what would that do to the climate. And they were already running, using these climate models at that time already to do the global warming analysis, but they turned them to this task.
And the Reagan administration really ramped up the Cold War in the 1980s with the whole discussion of intermediate-range nuclear missiles. And so politically speaking, the 80s were a much more tense period than even the 1970s.
For sure. And there are signs, in retrospect, of course, the Soviet effort was straining toward the late 80s. There were a lot of things going on domestically there that were, the United States was pressuring them in many ways. And when you added this to the mix, it kind of also gave a cover in a way. Gorbachev embraced nuclear winter. Reagan talked about it a little bit, and it gave another sort of logic to it. Was like mad, mutually assured destruction plus, with an exclamation point. Not only would the war be awful, and this would guarantee no winners.
Here's Carl Sagan talking specifically about how there is really no way to assess the data.
The global consequences of nuclear war is not a subject amenable to experimental verification, or at least not more than once. Maybe we've all made some serious mistake in the calculations, but I wouldn't want to bet my life on it.
He sounds so spooky there, but he's speaking directly.
He was really good at that stuff.
Yeah, he was really good at that stuff. And he really was far more persuasive than Reagan and Gorbachev in their diplomatic speak, even as profound as those world leaders were. Sagan really got people's attention.
Yeah, I wrote a long, long magazine article about this 31 years ago now in 1985 for Science Digest. It's kind of interesting to look back at it. It's kind of a nexus when science gets policy relevant and scientists have passions about peace or about environmental security, more recently with global warming, they get empowered. And Sagan was just a particularly effective spokesman. Paul Ehrlich was involved as well. Paul Crutzen, who later went on to win a Nobel Prize, who had helped reveal the ozone destruction from CFCs, was involved. So the National Academies of Science did a follow-up study. And then what happened, the issue kind of got interesting because more analysis. This happens often in science where an initial stark idea gets picked apart and studied more thoroughly and the models are getting more sophisticated. And it became more like nuclear autumn, which is kind of where's the headline there? But I think, as you were implying, it kind of already did the job in a way.
And the metaphors for what mutually assured destruction actually was were very, very powerful, coming from a Carl Sagan rather than from some sort of policy analyst at the Pentagon. Here, listen.
Imagine a room awash in gasoline, and there are two implacable enemies in that room. One of them has 9,000 matches. The other has 7,000 matches. Each of them is concerned about who's ahead, who's stronger. Well, that's the kind of situation we are actually in.
Carl Sagan saying that on ABC News in 1983. Was that the kind of situation we were actually in, scientifically speaking?
Well, in the sense that, as even with nuclear autumn, you know, you're talking about a substantial effect. And even today, scientists are pointing to that even with a modest exchange of nuclear weapons, if there is such a thing, between, say, Pakistan and India, Alan Robach at Rutgers has calculated you could get a substantial impact globally on agriculture and that kind of thing. So it really does hold up in that sense.
But the summit last week was mostly talking about keeping existing nuclear weapons and fissile material away from terrorists. And in that case, it would pose no danger really to the planet, but it would, of course, be an extraordinary civilian tragedy.
For sure. And, you know, although, again, to me, there still is this. I write for the opinion side of the paper, so I can kind of say what I think sometimes. And, you know, anything that reminds us that there still are these big arsenals out there, and humans are still fallible, even with the fail-safe technology, supposedly, that, you know, we have to kind of keep that in mind and think about consequences that might seem ridiculous, ridiculously unlikely, but that have to be considered.
So along with the terrorist scenario, you would warn about the Dr. Strangelove scenario as well?
You know, I'd like to think it's impossible, but, you know, I've covered enough impossible or implausible things that have happened that you start to think, well, you got to take this seriously.
Talking about the nuclear winter, which became the nuclear autumn, but was a very, very powerful scientific argument during the Cold War in the 1980s. Andy Revkin is writer of the Dot Earth blog with the New York Times. He's a professor at Pace University. Thanks so much, Andy.
You're welcome.
If you want to see the retro report look back at the nuclear winter argument during the Cold War, go to thetakeaway.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.